Hi, I'm Corey Raven, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we do our part to inspire recovery from addiction and discover a better way. Whether you're on the path right now of sobriety or you're considering getting on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories along your path to a better way. So buckle up as we hit the road together on this transformative journey. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and I want to welcome my co-host, Irene.
Hello.
Hello, Irene.
Corey.
We have a great guest today. Very exciting. We have never had an Olympic gold medal winner on Crosstalk Podcast, but here, a first today, an Olympic gold medal winner.
Yes.
Carrie B is with us. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right, let's jump right in. So, you know, tell us a little bit about you, just in a nutshell, and then we'll break it down, I guess.
Yeah. You know, like many of us, grew up in an alcoholic home, but I didn't actually know that that was the thing. Like, I didn't know that I thought everybody had a family that was as dysfunctional as mine was as a kid. And, you know, I think I didn't recognize how much that affected me. I didn't come from a household that I had to worry if the lights were going to be turned off, or, I had, you know, financial security. But there was a lot of fear in the house for me, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anger and fear as a child. And so really where I gravitated was to sports.
Okay. Was that pushed by your parents at all?
No, sports was not something that was pushed by my parents. As a matter of fact, I started swimming as a little girl only because my brother did it, who was a couple of years older than I was. It wasn't something I was necessarily drawn to. And I did other sports as a kid, you know, gymnastics and soccer, and I ran track and things like that. But I think as humans, we start to gravitate towards where we find success, and I happen to be pretty good at swimming. And so that's really where my focus started to narrow over the years.
Was that because there was structure in the sports, whereas unstructured life at home?
I think, of course, it was super reliable and dependable. You know, I knew exactly where I had to be every day at a certain time. You know, I was in the pool 2.5 hours in the morning before school. I was back in the pool 2.5 hours after school. My teammates became my family, but it was also being an individual sport. I always used to say nobody could see me cry underwater. You know, it was really where I would work out my anger and my fear and my frustrations at what was happening in my home. And, I would literally work myself so hard that I'd be so exhausted when I got home after practice that I could kind of shut out what was going on in the house. So it was like my safe place, you know? It's where I felt accepted. It's where I felt safe. It's where I felt loved and cared about.
It was like a family that you should have had at home.
Yep.
You created that for yourself when you went to school.
Yep. And again, my parents, you know, my father was a corporate executive, a successful corporate executive, and he was my hero my whole life. He was always there for me, even when he was traveling. You know, he was really my best friend. And it was my mom that struggled, you know. So because of my dad's position as a corporate executive and traveling all the time, I was home often with my mom. And she was the one that really, really struggled with alcoholism.
So when you say struggled, she struggled in relationships and in her work, or was she a stay-at-home mom?
Yeah, my mom was a stay-at-home mom my whole life. And she struggled as a woman back then with alcoholism when it was a topic that was not discussed for women. She was a corporate wife, so she would go to all the events that corporate wives need to do. She would entertain as a corporate wife. But inside, you know, I look back now, I couldn't see this as a child, of course, but I look back now and it's so sad how sad she was. you know, how much she struggled with her mental health, I think.
And so, you know, when you threw yourself into swimming and you were underwater, you said you can't cry underwater, which I love that. Did your addiction tendencies start there? Would you say like you were competitive in nature? Like what, tell me a little bit more of what propelled you to do that. Because you must be dedicated, right?
No, for sure.
To be an Olympic swimmer.
Yeah. You know, I don't think any my addiction qualities came out then. I do think I have a very strong competitive nature. I love to compete. I love a challenge. I loved training as much as I loved racing. And so I think that I was drawn to it, A, because I was finding success, and B, because it really fit well in my life then, because there's a lot of time when your head's buried in the water that you're spending kind of up here in this neighborhood, which ultimately, as you fast forward through the years, through the decades, ends up being the place that was the most dangerous for me to hang out in.
Right. Yeah.
So it served a lot of purposes for me as a kid, but it wasn't an addiction feeling more, it was more so competitive, and I loved winning. I loved it.
And what age were you when you won the Olympic gold?
I was 16.
Wow. So
just a couple years ago.
That's like peaking very, yeah. That's a big peak at 16.
Yeah, but you know, back then it wasn't so unusual. I was the second or third kind of youngest, I think, on the U.S. team in 1984. But back then the Olympic teams tended to be a little younger because there was no money to be made in Olympic sports, right, you know, back in the 80s. And so really when you were done with college, you had to go get a job, you know, you had to go be able to pay your rent and things like that. So now it's totally different, right? You have people competing in Olympic sports well into their 30s and making good money, and they can survive, and more than survive, they're thriving financially, mm-hmm, you know? So the teams tended to be a little younger back then.
And after you won at 16, mm-hmm, what did life look like after? Did you go to college? Mm-hmm. When did your drinking start?
Yeah. Life was really interesting after the Olympics. You know, I got thrust into a world that I certainly wasn't prepared for, and I didn't understand. You know, the next morning after my first, so we swam the first event, first day of the whole Olympics in 1984, and it was the women's 100 freestyle. And another American and I tied for the gold medal that day, and it was the first Olympic tie ever recorded in history. So it was a big deal, right? And I'm 16 and I'm thinking, this is so fun. Like, I couldn't wait to get out of the pool area at the Olympics to go show my parents my medal. But I didn't realize what a stir that causes from a security standpoint. Because again, I'm just happy to be there. I'm a kid. I want to share it with my family, right? That's all there in the stands.
What happened?
Well, I mean, of course, everyone comes around. Everyone wants to touch it and feel it. And then you can kind of feel that it's becoming a little unmanageable, the amount of people that are around. And so quickly, you know, some of the security took me back within the gates of the village to a more secure place. And I was able to then meet with my parents somewhere more secluded and not quite in the middle of all the people leaving the swimming venue. Was there drug use? For sure. Was everyone drinking? Of course. You know, when I was swimming for the national team, you know, we were abroad where, you know, most countries don't care how old you are to drink. Mm-hmm. And our coaches would basically say, if you haven't had your first drink, don't have it here. And then they'd go to their rooms, and what they didn't see, they didn't know, right?
Kind of what stays in Vegas, what
pretty much
in Vegas stays in Vegas, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, there was a lot of drinking, but we had kind of that mentality where we worked hard and we played hard, right? I really never felt like it was something that was so over the top where something stood out to me as problematic. It seemed very normal, you know, that there was a lot of drinking. I was pretty young, you know, at the beginning of my national team exposure. So, you know, the first time I got really drunk was on a plane flying home from a meet in Japan. And I drank so much I got sick on the plane, right? Probably should have known then that it was not going to be a good ending. But that's kind of the environment we were in, that I was in.
And what about like counteracting? Like, for example, when I was a chef, right, I drank a lot, but then I needed certain performance medications, like, well, they're not considered their performance for ADHD, but amphetamine salts, like, you know, to perform the next day, to endure almost, to actually even get through the pain. Like, so many people talk about pain medication, but I couldn't be like high in that sense. I needed to perform, get output. Was that part of it at all?
You know, I think that we were pretty smart about when we were partying. I mean, nobody was out drinking the night before they were racing. You know, it was usually after the big competitions. You know, only in college do I remember, you know, drinking until 2 and 3 in the morning and then, you know, being in the pool at 5, feeling like I was probably still intoxicated.
So since you won the Olympic at 16, you mentioned being in the pool at 5 at college. So tell us a little bit more about the transition into college. Yep. When did you finish your high school degree? Did you get a GED? What did that look like?
No, I finished high school like a regular student.
Okay.
And then I had, you know, I had I had many options of where to go to school on full scholarship for swimming. Mm-hmm. I was very blessed with that. And I ultimately decided on the University of Texas in Austin. They were by far the best swimming program in the country then. And I really knew that I wanted to be a Texas Longhorn when it came to swimming.
And they're a big party school, right?
Well, I mean, I think every college is kind of a big party. So you can kind of find it wherever you go.
I guess so. You're right.
But, you know, with 59,000 undergraduate students, to me, it was like a perfect place to get a little bit lost. You know, there was a lot of people I wanted to know and a lifestyle that I had. You know, I grew up pretty sheltered and in environments that were not super cultured. And when I got to Texas, it was a big eye opener to how big the world really is, you know, and what it has to offer. You know, the hard part for me, you know, kind of going back to the Olympics, I remember standing on the awards platform, having the gold medal put around my neck and feeling like a fraud.
Really?
Or like
imposter syndrome?
It was a bit of an imposter thing and just really uncomfortable in my own skin, like not knowing who I was. And it was really overwhelming, you know, to feel like that. And then when I went away to college, I had a lot of insecurity then too, because see, now we go into a new coach. Now we move into a program that I went from being a big fish in a small pond to now being a big fish with 30 other big fishes.
Right.
And the lack of trust with what the coach was saying to me versus, because in many cases, the woman that might have been my main competition collegiately in the country was also my teammate. Mm. So it began this very interesting, insecure, unknowing feeling when I got to school. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I think my drinking really probably did escalate in college. Put it this way, I think that the pilot light for me when it came to alcoholism was always lit. Like, I think it was no different than the pilot light on our stove or in our fireplace. You know, I think it was always kind of at this little slow, you know, burn. Mm-hmm. And then as the years ticked along, the flames just got, you know, brighter and brighter because, you know, I'm not sure I drank any differently than anybody else in college, but I'm not sure they had the pilot light, right? So the groundwork kind of started.
I'm not sure that any 16-year-old who gets a gold medal put around her neck could feel anything different than you felt. Mm. How can you feel like you're the greatest in the world at 16? It's a tough thing for a 16-year-old to really get their head around. So, but it's interesting. I think there's a connection between that and what you probably felt with 30 other big fish.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, maybe that was really, that was just a mistake.
Well, and you also have to remember that when you look at my life away from the pool, you know, I was in a situation where I didn't feel like I was enough for my mom to stop drinking. And I didn't feel like that she loved me enough, or that, you know, that I could bring enough joy into her life to where she wouldn't want to drink anymore, and that she just loved alcohol more than I did. So there's a lot of insecurity and feeling not enough, and, you know, all these emotions that we feel later in life that started in at a young age for me that I didn't really know how to articulate, right? So there's a lot that goes into that moment on the award stand. It's not just about that event and that medal that goes around your neck. It's your life that leads up to that point. Mm. And then you're standing there and everything kind of comes to a head in that moment.
It's interesting how you could, I mean, your mom was married to your dad.
Yeah.
But your dad could have been, you know, I mean, we know the answer is that somebody who's drinking as an alcoholic is responsible for their own behavior. Mm-hmm. And the idea that a little girl could somehow not be enough and cause mama to drink is insane.
Yeah.
But it's a legitimate thought for a young girl, for that matter, for an older girl.
It's very real.
What did you do after college?
Well, I mean, before we can go to after college, we have to go to 1988, 4 years later, when Olympic trials were once again, you know, upon us. And I was still ranked.
And you're 20 at
this
time.
I'm 20. Yeah. Still okay. Ranked number one in the world. And Olympic trials happened to be in Austin at my home pool that year. And Hunter Free was the first day of the entire competition. And I remember getting in the warm-up pool prior to my race, and I started to cry. And I completely lost it mentally. And I was afraid to race. I was afraid to be there. Felt a lot of pressure on myself. And I ended up not making that team. I was first alternate.
What? Wait, why were you afraid?
I mean, the thing with sports is if you stand up on the blocks and you don't have it mentally, you might as well just get down, right? Because, you know, because so, it, I mean, the mind is the most powerful muscle we have in our body, right?
Yeah.
And so I just lost this belief in myself.
Was it like performance anxiety?
I don't know. Maybe it was some performance anxiety. It was pressured as still being ranked number one in the world and to do this, to be, you know, to make this team again. And, you know, when you go from 16 to 20, there's not a lot that means a lot to you at 16, right? Like the value we place in things at 16 is not that deep, mm-hmm. you know, but at 20, you know, and having already had an Olympic experience, winning 3 gold medals and being part of something so incredibly unique and special and wanting that again so badly.
So at 20, you're the alternate. You're no longer the queen of the world.
Yeah.
Did that have an impact on your behavior when it comes to alcohol?
100%. That was the first time I actually... To paint the picture for you, within that natatorium that night, when the team is assembled, they assemble the entire Olympic team on the side of the pool in front of all mm-hmm. the fans and in the stands, and they, you know, they're all in their Team USA gear, and it's this huge celebration for everyone that's made the team. To make the U.S. Olympic team is incredibly difficult because they take you have to be first or second. Right. In every event, there is no subjectivity to this. There's no, you didn't look great today. So, but you've been good all year. So we're going to put you on the team. Right. You have to touch the wall first or second. And if you don't, it's very cut and dry. You either make it or you don't. Mm. And they assembled the team and I was in the stands and I had,
oh, that's such a blow.
And I had no plan B for my life. I had never considered that was going to happen to me, you know, there was no plan B for my life. So as the team is being introduced, my boyfriend at the time, my friends, everyone's on the side of that pool in their Team USA gear. And I was in the stands basically saying, it was like an out of body experience. And so that was the very first time I remember drinking for the sole purpose of not feeling.
Wow.
That was
that,
that
night?
No.
Wait, ask your
certainly
question
not.
Again.
It wasn't the last time. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it was the first time that you felt that, but it wasn't the last. How did that first time drinking to not feel, how did that work? Did it work well
it
for
worked.
You? It worked well.
Oh, yeah.
So you repeated that a few times.
A few times. But it's interesting because there's a gap in that time of my life and when I really was in full-blown alcoholism. Long gap.
So would you say, though, that's where you crossed the invisible line?
Yep.
Like I loved to say, because I remember crossing that invisible line.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it was certainly the first time I had put my foot over it. And, you know, it just was like life just went on and I was just lost. You know, my drinking, you know, on the outside, it looked like I had everything. I was the envy of many. I'm an three-time Olympic gold medalist. I have a successful career. I have a wonderful marriage and I have these two beautiful daughters, right? And on the outside, it really looked like perfection, right? And I was dying inside and I didn't really understand why, you know, I didn't understand what I was looking for. And what's interesting is I feel like I spent 30 years looking for something that 56 seconds made me feel like. Mm. Like I wanted to feel that again, what it felt like that day that I touched the wall. I wanted to feel like it felt to be that person. Like I was losing her and I didn't know how to hold on to her and nothing else in my life seemed to make me feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved my husband and I loved my children and I loved my career and I really had it all. But I felt like I had this big giant hole in my soul and I didn't know why. And so, you know, drinking for me was very social for many years, right? I mean, I had two pregnancies. I didn't drink through my pregnancies. I wouldn't say I was alcoholic drinking around my pregnancies before or after. But we lived a very social drinking life as a family. It was a very normal part of our life. All of our friends drank. We would get all of our kids together and all the parents would drink and the kids would play. And we would send them up to the bonus room and then we built a pool and then everybody was over. You know, I knew that there was a problem when we would sit down on a Tuesday night and one of my kids would say, "Who's coming over tonight?" So we had this revolving door all the time in our home of friends and their kids, and drinking was a normal part of that. But what I noticed was that my drinking went from, you know, the traditional Friday and Saturday night to maybe a Thursday night to then wanting to drink while I made dinner or drink when, you know, when we had people over that would just stop by on a Wednesday. And then I noticed that I would want to drink and my husband would say, "It's Wednesday. I don't really want to have a glass of wine." And so then the hiding starts and the sneaking starts and, you know, things started to escalate for me very quickly. I always say, like, I feel like my disease started a little later. I was kind of ramping, mm-hmm. right? I ramped for some years and then full-blown disease happened a little later, but very quickly for me.
How old were you?
I was in my 40s.
Okay.
I was in my 40s when it really got me like kind of by the neck.
And it was just alcohol?
It was just alcohol for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. It was just alcohol for me. Drugs wasn't a big part of my life or the people that I spent time with because, I mean, we were athletes. So, you know, we were tested all the time and it just wasn't like drugs just weren't a thing.
Yeah.
And so that was never like a fallback for me, was drugs. But it was, so it was always alcohol. Yeah.
Before you found sustainable recovery and the turning point, tell me now what hell on earth was like.
Yeah. Hell on earth. Right. It's that demoralization, that, that's that extreme suffering that we all have in common. That, the look on from other people of not being a human, you know, being told it would be better for my kids if I just disappeared, that they would be better off. You know, I think that we're told so many really hard things because of the shame and the stigma that comes along with this disease. Because a lot of us do bad things when we're under the influence, right? I made a lot of bad decisions when I was drinking. I drank and drove with my kids in the car, but I would justify it and say, my kids never missed a sporting event. My kids never missed a practice because I was, you know, my life wasn't unmanageable. But, you know, I failed to mention that I was drinking and driving when I was taking my kids to sports, or that, you know, all those types of things. So, you know, it took me a long time to understand that those things that were told to me were lies, because I believed every bit of them. You know, by the time I got to treatment the last time in February of 2012, I mean, I showed up as a shell of a human being, right? You know, like, you talk about the Olympic girl and then this amazing career and mom and marriage to who I was when I walked in the doors in 2012. And there is no, there's no connection to those people at all. There's, I mean, zero. And the only reason I went back to treatment, that was my fourth time going into residential treatment in 2 years. And the only reason I did go one more time was because I decided at home alone in January that year that I would stop drinking on my own cold turkey, knowing, you know, knowing the risks of that from a detox and withdrawal perspective, because I didn't want to live. I had lost every amount of will to live, but I also didn't know how to, you know, kill myself.
Right. Didn't want to die. Right.
And so I decided I would stop drinking cold turkey, and I made a deal with myself that if I survived, I would go one more time and try and save my life.
And so, that was the turning point, you would say?
Yep.
So for people who are struggling right now, who are watching Crosstalk Podcast,
yep,
and they're listening to your interview, what message would you have for those people? What do you want to tell them?
Yeah, just don't give up. Don't ever give up. Recovery is possible. It's alive, it's well, it's happening all around you. As long as we're still breathing, we've got a chance.
Normally ask at the end of every podcast what you would say to a version of your younger self, but I want to actually get specific with you, if that's okay.
Sure.
And also generalize it to, like, what could you go back and say to that girl that was sidelined?
Yeah.
And kind of taken from this high level stature and kind of like, sorry, you can't perform anymore. What would you go back and say to that young girl?
I think I would go back to her and say that it never defined you. You know, swimming was what you did, not who you were. And there's a huge difference in that.
And then, you know, I'd like you to now answer that in a personal way. Like, if you could go back to any portion of your life, even as a mother or as a 30, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
What would you go back and say to yourself at any age? What age would it be? And what would you say?
I think that I would go back to maybe two places. One, I would go back to being that scared kid. And I'd set a place for her at the dinner table and let her know that she's going to be okay.
I love that.
And then I think I would go back to my to when my kids were little and when I continually broke their hearts.
Ugh.
And tell them that and tell myself that nobody could tell me that I didn't love my kids as much as any other mom.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to tell our listeners, hopefully you enjoyed this. And if you did, like us, follow us, hit the bell and give us your comments. Tell us what you like, what you want to see more of, what suggestions you might have. And Irene, take us out.
All right. Well, thank you. What am I saying?
You're going to say thank you for watching.
Oh, I thought you just did.
No,
well thank you so much for watching.
She really means to say we really appreciate you watching Crosstalk, and we'll see you next time.